killed just after statehood, and that the KKK had marched past when Ralph was 9. The restaurant inside was newly renovated. Klaus and I sat next to a futuristic-looking gas fireplace, and at one point the waiter brought us complimentary oatmeal cookies with a list of ingredients that went on for about 30 seconds. We spoke for several hours, and later Klaus took me for a driving tour of OKC, and at every point in our time together, I marveled that Jim Couch would ever send anyone to speak with Russell Klaus about anything at all, let alone the boulevard, or anything even tangentially related to city planning. To say that the two men did not see eye to eye hardly begins to describe it. The two men did not have the same organs of sight. They were like a bumblebee and a squid looking at the same cloud. Russell Klaus was an outsider. He came from Australia. A series of unfortunate events had brought him to Oklahoma nearly 20 years before, and he had helped to rebuild the empty downtown, and he seemed perpetually astonished to find himself still there. Klaus was an outspoken, cosmopolitan, atheist, progressive rabble-rouser in a place that disapproved, vehemently, of all of those things. As we drove, he pointed out with particular relish the many planning failures that still plagued downtown. Parking garages plunked into the middle of previously vital neighborhoods, empty lots that once held magnificent skyscrapers, neglected alleys, defunct streetcar tracks, a lack of residential buildings bordering the park. Director of planning in Oklahoma City was a uniquely frustrating job. The city was born, of course, in the spirit of boom, a crime against the very notion of planning, and that spirit was still very much alive. For most of its history, OKC's planning decisions had been ad hoc, disorganized, and myopic. When they were directed from above, it was usually in secret, by powerful men such as Stanley Draper. Public interest and corporate interests were frequently deemed to be one and the same. Even today, the most basic fundamentals of planning, zoning, for instance, were considered a form of communism. Klaus said that one city council member actually referred to him, habitually, as comrade. "The state is full of lunatics," Klaus told me. "It's kind of an embarrassment." His planning meetings, he said, were often hijacked by complete tinfoil hat guys, extreme anti-government activists. I say, "Well, how did you get here?" "On a road." "How did that road get built?" That kind of logic is lost on them. I say, "You don't want taxes, you don't want government. There's some great examples of that around the world. Somalia, Libya, Sudan, Eritrea. That's what you want? In your quest for personal property rights and freedom from the government? Those places don't even have as many guns as we do." Klaus was aligned, in general, with the placemakers. He abhorred the American worship of automobiles and all of the urban diseases it spawned. Sprawl, malls, big box stores, interstates amputating historic neighborhoods. He believed in walkable streets, strong public transportation, mixed-use neighborhoods, a thriving downtown. In the planning world, all of this was perfectly orthodox. Among the old guard in OKC, however, it was a scandal. Klaus was not allowed to cite, as models, progressive cities such as Vancouver, Portland, or Boulder, because those places were considered too liberal. When he proposed a new idea, he had to show that it had already been implemented in a conservative peer city, such as Nashville or Fort Worth. Klaus told me he had good senior-level planning jobs open, but he couldn't convince anyone to come to Oklahoma City to take them. "The engineers are in charge," he told me. "They're not broad-thinking people. In their mind, their job is only to move traffic. They'll have cars running from one end of the country to the other, and they'll just drop them off in the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean. It really wouldn't matter to them. In my world, there are connections all over the place, multiple different factors that all influence each other, and you try to guide them as much as you possibly can in a way that incubates the good and suppresses the bad. But it's not a perfect science. There are principles that have been proven to work pretty well, but there's always flexibility. For engineers, it's much more black and white. Get the big projects done, on time and on budget. There's not a lot of thought about why we're doing them. They're afraid of things that they can't get a formula for. These are community and economic development projects, but they're all being managed as construction projects. In the case of the Oklahoma City Boulevard, Klaus said, planners had not been part of the discussion. The design was 15 years old, and the engineers didn't particularly care that downtown had changed drastically in the interim. The plan was the plan. Klaus said that this was largely a product of the city manager's devotion to doing things, no matter what, according to the approved script. If you have a process, in his view, that just deals with everything, Klaus said of Jim Couch. It covers his ass with the politicians, because he had a process. They thought the process with the boulevard was great. And I'm saying, well, it wasn't an outcome-based process. It was a process to have a process. Transportation engineers are classic at running a public process to say, here's what we're doing, thank you for your input, and now we're going to do whatever the hell we wanted to do anyway. Because of this, Klaus said, the fight to meaningfully change the boulevard was doomed. It might happen in 50 years, he said. I think we make a lot of mistakes that can be corrected, but it has to be in 50 years. As we drove around town, Klaus often spoke in these terms. He would point to what had once been Main Street, now cut in half. A 100-year mistake, he said. He would point to a parking garage, a 25-year mistake. The Stanley Draper Expressway, Klaus said, was a 50-year mistake, and now its time was over. But its replacement, the Oklahoma City Boulevard, looked like it would be another 50-year mistake. This kind of thing would continue, Klaus said, as long as Oklahoma City stuck to its old top-down power structure, allowing the important decisions to be made in private by a handful of rich, white, conservative men. The original ones all died off, Klaus told me, so there was a little bit of a vacuum. Now you've got this new elite coming up, the Aubrey McClendons and Clay Bennetts of the world. They have grand visions. Generally, I'd say it's been quite positive. There's a lot of philanthropy. But there has never been that understanding, as you get in European and Canadian and Australian cities, of how to address the entire community's needs. It's more, let's do these big projects, and everything will trickle down. This had largely worked, of course, in the case of the Thunder, a grand vision driven by the money and obsession of rich white businessmen, including McClendon and Bennett. I asked Klaus if he was a fan of the team. He was not. Although Klaus conceded that the Thunder had been a large part of the city feeling good about itself, and he insisted that this effect was real and powerful, he mostly resented it as a distraction from real, urgent, grown-up business. The Thunder is like another religion, he said. And here we were already dealing with church 6 nights a week. When it's NBA season, that's all people talk about. It bottlenecks things. Oh, we can't work on that tonight because there's a Thunder game on. You know, the rest of the world couldn't give a fuck about this. Klaus turned wistful. Once upon a time, he said, in the first half of the 20th century, before men like Stanley Draper cranked the gears of sprawl, Oklahoma City had actually been a sophisticated urban place. Downtown was full of elegant buildings and popular shops and pedestrians. The streetcar system was world class. This was a real city, he insisted. If it had continued to develop at that same rate, I mean, today it would be Seattle. What is it now? I asked. He thought for a second. His voice became sad. Oklahoma City, he said. I asked Klaus if that glorious future might be salvageable. If, in 50 years, Oklahoma City could be another Portland, or Vancouver, or Seattle, or Denver. Could be, he said. There's no reason it can't still be the shining city on the plains. What are the odds? I asked. He thought again. Then said, 1 in 100? Controlled progressive collapse. All at once, on a Sunday afternoon in 1977, the people of OKC came back to the center of the city. A crowd of 30,000 gathered and jostled for position. They had come to witness a public execution, the final death of the old downtown. Blasting area, said a sign. Site of unique myriad gardens said another. The crowd massed around one of the city's signature skyscrapers, the Biltmore Hotel, an ancient giant of the skyline, 28 stories tall, nearly 300 feet. Its upper floors stepped stylishly back, like a ziggurat, with enormous letters on the roof, Hotel Biltmore. The story of the Biltmore was, in many ways, the story of downtown. It towered up from the intersection of Grand and Harvey, exactly where, in the days of the land run, angry crowds had gathered in the dust and grass to argue over the shape of the city. In fact, the Biltmore sat right on one of OKC's infamous jogs, where the street grid hitched suddenly over Grand. The building went up during the Great Depression. It was one of a burst of new skyscrapers that proved, as the world's economy crashed, that Oklahoma City was special, chosen, charmed. The city at the time was still riding its original oil boom. The Biltmore Hotel had 619 rooms, green stone floors, 7 elevators, and an enormous rug in the lobby woven with idealized scenes from the history of OKC. A teepee, a covered wagon, an oil well, and an image of the Biltmore itself. Amelia Earhart stayed there. Hollywood stars danced to live orchestras in its ballrooms. At age 13, Bobby Fischer played his first major chess tournament at the Biltmore. For decades, many thousands of dollars were wagered every night in secret games in the hotel's back rooms, including, on Christmas Eve 1945, a single legendary roll of the dice in which a local institution, Cattleman's Steakhouse, changed hands. The Biltmore made OKC seem big time. Tourists sent postcards of it back home. Within a block of the hotel, you could get your hair cut, pick up flowers, buy a necklace, see a movie, or shop at a specialty store that sold only vacuum cleaners. Katz was right around the corner. Sears was directly across the street. The Biltmore stood at the center of a whole thriving world. By 1977, however, downtown was something very different. No one came there for fun anymore. All of those shops had moved out. The streetcar lines had been torn up and replaced by buses. Although the economy was once again booming with oil and new construction was going up everywhere, very little of that energy was finding its way downtown. On October 16th, 1977, however, the people were suddenly back. They thronged around the Biltmore, huddling shoulder to shoulder, looking for the best angles. Some stood on the roofs of nearby buildings. Police worked to maintain a safe perimeter. All normal business in the area, or what was left of it, had been temporarily discontinued. Streets were closed to traffic. For 20 years, downtown had been starved for exactly this kind of energy, this kind of crowd. But this was the sad irony of the day. The only reason to come downtown anymore was to watch downtown come down. The forces that changed the city had been too strong to hold off. After World War II, Oklahoma City found itself subjected to a set of pressures that were operating nationwide. A generation of young white veterans, now heavily subsidized by the federal government, were attending college, buying homes, and starting families. A million suburban developments bloomed, fed by the interstate highways. It was an era of TV and AC. Cities sprawled. Public life began to recede. Malls rose up to service the suburbs, and shops that had anchored central business districts for decades began to close or relocate. All over the country, from Seattle to Minneapolis to El Paso to Niagara Falls, planners were forced to reckon with a difficult question. What was the role of the old downtown in this newly dispersed city? Formerly bustling streets grew quiet. Display windows sat empty, and when they cracked, owners often replaced them with boards instead of glass. Oklahoma City, of course, was even more radically dispersed than other cities. By 1960, it was 9 times larger than it had been before World War II. Concentric horseshoes of identical houses began to sprout at the end of every freeway, and the booming middle classes poured out into them. When Clara Looper was orchestrating her sit-ins downtown, developers opened the Penn Square Mall 5 swift miles northwest, and the spacious new stores and restaurants drew off many of Katz's former customers. The balance of the city had swung. Stanley Draper could see, looking out his office window, that downtown was in decline. Blocks that had once been solid with shops were beginning to show patches of vacancy. Foot traffic had thinned. The energy was draining away. Fortunately, Draper was also aware of a solution. In 1950, Pittsburgh had started a pioneering program of urban renewal, and Draper tracked it with interest. The old city bulldozed dilapidated blocks and replaced them with modern structures, convention centers, highways, parking garages, office towers. All through the 1950s, this trend spread across America. In Norfolk and Baltimore and San Francisco and Cleveland, old wood and brick and stone structures gave way to glass and poured concrete. It was the Phoenix principle of city planning, rebirth through destruction. Boston was mowing down some of the oldest neighborhoods on the continent. A new generation now drove the economy, and it had no interest in its grandparents' crowded downtown streets and specialty shops and soda fountains. To survive, downtown would have to reinvent itself. Oklahoma City, clearly, was not Boston or Pittsburgh. Its oldest major downtown buildings were hardly even 50 years old. And yet Stanley Draper and the other major powers loved the idea of urban renewal beyond all reason or restraint. The land run had left the city center frozen in disarray. Its lots were tiny, owned by many different people, impossible to coordinate. The street grid was fundamentally warped. Decades of organizing from on high had not been able to fix it. Urban renewal provided the opportunity. It was, finally, a force of order powerful enough to counteract the initial chaos of the land run, a process strong enough to answer the city's original boom. It would allow planners to get down to civic bedrock and start over. If the pioneers had created an entire city in a single day, why couldn't modern engineers, with their superior technology, completely destroy that city and remake it in a matter of years? In the mid-1950s, Draper, Gaylord, and a small group of business leaders took a private plane to study urban renewal in eastern cities. They also went to Washington, D.C. to lobby for federal funds to start a program in OKC. Urban renewal, these men had decided, was the only possible future for downtown. Naturally, back home, there was resistance. In 1959, the Democratic candidate for mayor issued a laundry list of warnings about urban renewal. Among other things, he told voters, it destroys homes, creates new slums, increases juvenile delinquency, and casts a cloud on the title to every piece of property. But that candidate lost the race to Jim Norick, the telegenic young proponent of modernity and growth. Under Draper's influence, Oklahoma's governor signed a new law that allowed cities to eliminate slums, blight, and deterioration, wonderfully fluid categories for the men doing the eliminating. Critics filed a lawsuit charging that it was unconstitutional for a city to seize property willy-nilly. This challenge was enough to put the bulldozers on hold as the case wound its way through the courts. The delay drove Stanley Draper crazy. Oklahoma City, he felt, was already falling behind. Downtown was getting visibly worse. This was a civic emergency. If OKC hesitated, all of the gains it had worked so desperately for, all of that leaping up the national rankings, would be lost. Draper sprang into action. He deployed the full power of the Chamber of Commerce, marshaling the city's bankers and energy titans, pooling their money to form a new nonprofit entity he called the Urban Action Foundation. The UAF acted immediately and aggressively to do what the official government could not, to start urban renewal, now, in Oklahoma City. First, the Urban Action Foundation imported the men responsible for Cleveland's urban renewal program. This included a visionary young architect named I.M. Pei, a rising star educated at MIT and Harvard, whose E-Review plan had called for a near-total reset of Cleveland's declining downtown. Draper's UAF paid pay $200,000, the equivalent of nearly $2 million today, to come up with something similar for Oklahoma City. On December 10, 1964, OKC got all it had paid for and more. In the Persian room of the Skirvin Hotel, in front of 600 people, I.M. Pei unveiled the Pei Plan, a program of downtown annihilation that dwarfed even what was being done in Cleveland. It was breathtakingly extreme. On the map of the plan, crosshatched lines marked the buildings set for demolition, and there were so many it looked like a map of bomb damage in post-Blitz London. In Cleveland, urban renewal had wiped out most of 163 acres. In Oklahoma City, it would destroy most of 528. Plenty of cities by 1964 were clearing downtown land, but almost no one was going this far. In the Skirvin, Pei showed off a large model of the future downtown, 10 feet by 12 feet, roped off like a museum exhibit. It was so detailed there were tiny cars winding between the buildings. The people of OKC gathered around to admire their future. What they saw was a modernist utopian fantasy, a triumph of pure geometry. Residents would live and work in glass towers. Visitors would stay in glass hotels. A state-of-the-art convention center would sit next to an enormous park. Public transportation, Pei believed, was essentially dead, so a network of superhighways and one-way streets would funnel cars into downtown parking garages. OKC's tiny blocks would expand into unified superblocks. Main Street itself, a quaint notion in this evolving world, would be torn up to make room for a giant downtown mall. The plan would not be fully complete, Pei said, until 1989. This happened to be an important year, the centenary of the land run. Finally, on its 100th birthday, Oklahoma City would be the world-class, cutting-edge metropolis its original founders had dreamed of. You may ask yourself if you cannot afford it, Pei told city leaders. We think you have no choice. You have a wonderful bargain to get more for your money than any city in the country in this plan. Stanley Draper was delighted. He and Pei spoke constantly about the city's transformation. OKC's grand new Central Park was going to be modeled on Copenhagen's Tivoli Gardens. So Draper and the rest of the Urban Action Foundation actually flew to Denmark to inspect the real thing. Draper, according to his traveling companions, walked around Copenhagen like he owned it, as if it were just an unusually distant neighborhood of Oklahoma City. To sell Pei's vision to the rest of the city, the Chamber of Commerce and the Urban Action Foundation unleashed a PR offensive. Draper promised the business community $100 million in new construction, plus nationwide accolades for the boldness of their vision. Propaganda films were produced. One showed the Pei model, filmed with a special periscopic lens, contrasted with shabby footage of OKC's actual downtown. Just before Christmas, readers of the Sunday Oklahoman found a lavish 12-page color insert illustrating the glories of urban renewal. Nothing less than major surgery can save downtown Oklahoma City, it claimed. If the patient dies, the remainder of the city will be disastrously affected. There was a moment before the destruction actually began, in late 1966 or early 1967, when the Pei plan could have been stopped. Critics tried, pointing out the already clear failures of urban renewal in other cities. In downtown Cleveland, for instance, where Pei's Erie View district now sat idle and undeveloped, destroyed but not rebuilt, a swath of empty land that locals referred to as Hiroshima Flats. Momentum, however, was on the side of change. Downtown was actually getting worse. All this talk of urban renewal had created a feedback loop, exacerbating the problem it was supposed to fix. Downtown landlords had stopped renovating because they didn't know if their buildings would survive, and the lack of repairs caused more businesses to flee to the suburbs. Main Street was beginning to look deserted. Meanwhile, after a long review process, the federal funding for urban renewal came pouring in, more than $30 million to help carry out Pei's plan. OKC could not possibly turn that down. Wichita, New Orleans, Minneapolis, Kansas City, St. Louis, Dallas, and Houston, all of these competitors had already built themselves new convention centers. How could Oklahoma City afford to wait any longer? It didn't. In 1967, the bulldozers were finally set loose. They would swarm over downtown for the next several years, demolishing decades of the city's history. As the Great Annexation drove the edges of the city outward, urban renewal ravaged its interior. Even the Urban Renewal Authority's office on Park Avenue was destroyed by urban renewal. The authority had to take refuge in the stately Colcord, one of the few historic skyscrapers left intact. Some of the ruins were filled in the early 1970s, by a wave of construction largely paid for with federal funds. The Liberty Tower, a 500-foot-tall, pinstriped rectangle of dark glass. The McGee Tower, a 30-story headquarters for the local energy giant Kerr McGee. The new convention center. Past all the construction ran a new 6-lane thoroughfare lined with parking garages, a road that would eventually be named in honor of E.K. Gaylord, and which connected, naturally, to the Stanley Draper Expressway. By 1973, the city was ready to move on to the crucial second phase of Pei's plan, the construction of the Super Mall and the Super Park. By this time, however, urban renewal had fallen out of favor nationwide. After 20 years, its failures were impossible to ignore. Countless downtowns had been ruined instead of renewed. In Oklahoma City, demolitions now frequently drew protesters, some of whom marched in symbolic funeral processions. Federal funding was beginning to dry up. In downtown OKC, the destruction was horrifying. Architectural showpieces had come down everywhere. The 8-story Mercantile Building, tidy and white. The Warner Theater, once home to the grandest stage in the city, where Sarah Bernhardt and other legends had performed. The Terminal Building, where the streetcars used to turn around. The Criterion Theater, whose fancy columns made it look vaguely Parisian. The Baum Building, modeled on the Doge's Palace in Venice. Elegant white exterior, ornate spiraling cupolas, windows upon windows upon windows. These are not merely huge buildings, Angelo Scott had written about OKC's new skyline in the 1930s. They are artistic structures, within and without, worthy to stand in any city. By the mid-1970s, that skyline was ruined. Downtown was desolate. It would be as if New York City had decided to raze not only the old Penn Station, but the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building too, plus Macy's and Grand Central Terminal. In 1974, John A. Brown's, the department store that had anchored downtown OKC for nearly 60 years, finally gave up and left. A wrecking ball rolled in and blew away the building, whose stately arches had occupied nearly an entire block of Main Street. Grass and weeds, sensing an opportunity, began to emerge downtown. Oklahoma City seemed to be reverting to its early days, scraping the civilization right off of itself, lot by lot. Given enough bulldozers and time, it might have turned entirely back into prairie. Further destruction seemed pointless, reckless, destruction for destruction's sake. No new buildings were sprouting from the ruins. Members of the city council suggested that perhaps the city didn't need to follow through with the rest of Pei's plan. Perhaps some of Main Street might be preserved as an old town, a touch of quirky charm among all the new glass boxes. Merchants took out radio ads to criticize urban renewal. The planners, however, were drunk on their plans. The Urban Renewal Authority had grown into a monster with 125 employees and $60 million in assets. It moved in such secrecy that even the city council often had no idea what it was up to. The destruction rolled forward, as scheduled. In the midst of all this, I.M. Pei came back to check on Oklahoma City. "I'm coming in like Rip Van Winkle," he said, with his trademark charm. He told city leaders that he was excited by the progress he saw, the convention center, the glass towers. But he also had a serious concern. The remaining projects, he warned, must be started immediately. The stalled mall and the raw park could not be allowed to fail. "Delay too long," Pei said, "and the public would lose confidence. Finish the job." "It is a very difficult thing to do," he said, "but you have to do it." Perhaps, Pei suggested, city leaders should hold a groundbreaking ceremony just to improve the people's mood. And then he flew away. The Pei plan, curiously, did not call for the destruction of the Biltmore Hotel. That was an icon of downtown, and Pei had made it clear that it should be left standing on the northern edge of the giant park, an envoy of the old world presiding over the new. Oklahoma City's hysteria for urban renewal, however, had already exceeded the Pei plan. Officials were beginning to freelance, destroying buildings that were not on his list. Some deep psychological impulse had taken over. Destruction, domination, the total conquest of space-time. By 1977, the citizens of OKC were used to seeing buildings come down. It was all part of the process, they had been told, of civic self-improvement. They tried to accept that. These were people who did not like to complain. But the destruction of the Biltmore felt different. The building was shabby and empty, yes. The hotel had closed back in 1973, but it was downtown. It was tall enough that you could see it from great distances as you drove on the freeway out to the suburbs, a monument to remind you that even if you never went there anymore, the city center did still exist. In those days, however, the Biltmore was like a ghost of the previous city. It stood alone in an alien landscape, no longer surrounded by cafes, cleaners, banks, theaters, and every kind of clothing store. Now there were drug addicts, homeless camps, prostitutes. For the average middle-class citizen, downtown was a place to drive through, if absolutely necessary, but not a place to stop. The Biltmore's luxurious interior had been stripped and sold off to pay old debts. When workers from Southwestern Bell went through the hotel, room by room, to remove the old phones, they had to kick down doors that had been locked by the squatters living inside. In 1977, the Biltmore's abandoned shell stood decrepit on the horizon, still visible from across the city, only now a symbol not of the center's vitality, but of its failure. And so, on October 16th, the morning of the demolition, the masses gathered. TV crews set up to broadcast the destruction nationwide. The Stanley Draper Expressway, now 10 years old, rose slightly south of the Biltmore, and drivers on it pulled over, got out of their cars, and stood on the freeway to watch. Draper had died the year before, in 1976, an event memorialized by nearly the entire front page of the Oklahoman. And this demolition seemed like another fitting tribute, one more spectacular blow in his lifelong mission to make the city great. The Biltmore Hotel was about to become the tallest building in America ever brought down by explosives. Some spectators cried. This felt like the death of the Oklahoma City they had grown up in. There was some buzz in the crowd about something moving in one of the hotel's windows, a blanket, it looked like, or a curtain. People whispered that maybe someone was in there, but the building had been checked and found to be empty. The Biltmore's skeleton was steel, which made it unusually strong, so 800 pounds of explosives had been distributed from the basement to the 14th floor. The city had hired for the job a pioneer in the field of architectural destruction, a company from Maryland called Controlled Demolition Incorporated, and the firm called this technique Controlled Progressive Collapse. A warning siren sounded. The crowd counted down. There was a series of faint pops, like the crackling of fireworks, and then a deep rumble, and the Biltmore Hotel basically turned to smoke. Its outline fuzzed, and then it lay down, almost gently, right onto its own footprint. The head of the demolition company told a reporter that the collapse had been perfect, better than we expected. We asked God for wisdom, and the good Lord turned on his gravity a little harder. All around the building, people nearly choked on the dust. When the smoke cleared, it was revealed that the first two floors had failed to fall. The nub of the Biltmore, including its grand old lobby, still stood there, stubbornly rooted to the old downtown, refusing to be renewed. A demolition crew had to go in later and knock it down the old-fashioned way, with bulldozers. In the meantime, the crowd surged forward into the rubble, grabbing bricks and Venetian blinds and other wreckage as relics of a vanished world. The Chamber of Commerce took its own souvenir, a large piece of marble from the Biltmore's lobby. This was carried, immediately, several blocks away, where it was added to a strange sort of outdoor museum. Directly next to the chamber's offices, in a tiny concrete plaza tucked into the middle of one of IMPA's huge new parking garages, curious pedestrians could visit a new memorial to the old downtown. It consisted entirely of pieces of the buildings destroyed by urban renewal. There was a stone lion's head from the old terminal building, and finials from the Criterion Theater. There was a grand white spire and a cupola from the bomb building. Each object was labeled with an explanatory plaque. It was hard to read the tone of this parking garage museum, to tell if it was intended as reverential, regretful, triumphant, or mocking. It was tempting to think of it in medieval terms, a victorious army displaying the decapitated heads of its enemies on pikes just outside the city gates. Now, to this bounty, the chamber added its authentic piece of the Biltmore Hotel. Years later, when the chamber moved its offices, these artifacts were left behind, in the plaza in the middle of the old garage, where the pieces of the missing buildings weathered and cracked, forgotten and unloved. Sometimes people used them as ashtrays, and many of them were eventually broken or stolen. All over downtown, the spots these buildings had once occupied remained empty. The destruction of the Biltmore Hotel would be remembered for decades as a turning point in the history of the city. Where that turn led, however, was not at all where the planners had planned. Game 46, The Neutrality of Tabo Cephalosha. On January 31st, the Memphis Grizzlies came to town. No one was particularly excited. It was a Thursday night, game 46 out of 82, right in the teeth of the mid-season grind, when the adrenaline of the early months has worn off and the inhumanity of the NBA schedule is becoming hard to ignore. Fatigue, injuries, boredom. Teams knew what they had and what they lacked. The Thunder had been on the road for most of January, including the previous six games in a row, nearly two solid weeks of enforced togetherness, during which time they'd won and lost, won and lost, won and lost. A frustrating pattern for a championship contender. Not niceness continued to bloom. Small irritations flared into grievances. There were rumors in the press about a rift between Kevin Durant and Serge Ibaka. It was some relief, then, to finally be back home, where the team rarely lost, where everyone could get away from one another and find their own space. Outside, the Oklahoma wind was an ice harpy shrieking through the streets, punishing all humans for the crime of having skin. Thunder fans fought through it and filed into the arena, turning themselves from many small individuals into one big sold-out crowd. The customary 18,203. On the floor, the players warmed up. Kendrick Perkins crab-walked all over the court with a giant rubber band attached to his waist. Nick Collison missed a baseline dunk. Durant was lofting up silly shots, moon balls from the left elbow. He missed three in a row, then made his fourth, and immediately turned and walked off the court. A game like this was all willpower and professionalism. The ability to force your body and mind to move in directions they didn't naturally want to move. A referee stood at the edge of the floor, by himself, practicing jump ball tosses. It was process time in the NBA. This made it the Grizzlies' kind of game. Their slogan was grit and grind. They were big, tough, and unglamorous at every position, and they basically beat the shit out of you. They were stagnation incarnate. These two teams knew each other uncomfortably well. In the playoffs 2 years before, the Grizzlies had stagnated all over the Thunder for 7 games and 3 overtimes. The Thunder had eventually won the series, but then lost to Dallas in the following round, possibly out of sheer exhaustion. Memphis's defense was designed to put constant stress on an offense, to find whatever hairline cracks already existed, and then press them into full-blown fractures. In the case of the Thunder, that pressure would fall on the cracks between self-interest and the collective good, between Westbrook's freelancing and Durant's efficiency, between the gaudy talent of the superstars and the mere competence of the role players. From the opening tip, the energy of the game felt off. There was a disturbance in the force. This was likely coming from the Grizzlies, who just the day before had traded away their leading scorer, Rudy Gay, but had yet to receive any new players in return. Gay's remaining teammates seemed to be in mourning. The starting lineup was a patchwork. The Thunder opened the game by running an isolation play, not for Westbrook or Durant, but for their starting shooting guard, Thabo Sefolosha. Sefolosha had many things going for him. His name was a perfect Euro-burble. Lost Ogle. Every time I say Sefolosha, I imagine that I have a mouthful of Jell-O, and I'm just squishing it out through my teeth. He had the smooth good looks of an R&B singer, or a designer scarf model. And he was a first-rate perimeter defender, who often hounded opposing stars into embarrassing nights. But he was not a scorer. The Grizzlies were guarding him with Mike Conley, their tiny point guard, who was a whole head shorter, basically daring Sefolosha to shoot. The Thunder accepted the challenge. Sefolosha backed Conley down near the hoop, pump-faked, spun toward the rim, and, as soon as a second defender came over to help, passed to his now wide-open teammate, Serge Ibaka, who made the jump shot. It was teamwork 101. The basketball gods were pleased, clearly, because the Thunder went on to make their first 9 shots of the game, an improbable feat against the Grizzlies' defense, trade or no trade. By the middle of the first quarter, the game was already beginning to feel like a blowout. The home crowd was burbling toward rapture. And yet, still, there was something naggingly off. For one thing, Russell Westbrook looked disturbingly Westbrookian. He threw a beautiful pass for an Ibaka dunk, then a terrible pass directly to an opponent. He charged down the court and hurdled himself into a pull-up jumper. Swish. And then Durant found him for a 3. Boom. And then he flung his body into another pull-up jumper. Swish. Westbrook was hot, but in a way that was slightly troubling. I kept writing, uh-oh, in my notebook. He had that why-not look about him. Because of the trade, the Grizzlies had been forced to start a bench player named Jared Bayless, and Bayless and Westbrook had a history. Both had been drafted in 2008. Both were explosive, reckless, emotional, not quite point guards. Some analysts had argued before the draft that Bayless would be the better NBA player. But this was not how it had turned out, and now it was as if Westbrook were playing against a suboptimal version of himself. An alternate reality version, in which he hadn't panned out, and he clearly wanted to destroy the imposter. To make things worse, in the first quarter, Bayless was just as hot as Westbrook, mirroring him on the other end. Three-pointer, flying jumper, pull-up jumper, reckless layup, pull-up jumper. He was making why-not shots, too, and Westbrook was taking it personally. Team basketball was turning into one-on-one. Westbrook isolated on Bayless and banked in another pull-up jumper. Again, in my notebook, I scribbled, uh-oh. Near the end of the first quarter, when Westbrook sat down, he had 11 points, 2 assists, and 3 turnovers. An impressive but terrifying stat line for 11 minutes of work. Bayless finished the quarter with 12 points, 2 assists, and no turnovers. it was an unsustainable pace. At halftime, the Thunder led by 24. But why not would eventually get its answer. Whenever I saw Thabo Sefolosha, I always ended up staring at his tattoo. It was one of the great body art masterpieces in the entire NBA. On his left shoulder, in the position of prime visibility, there was a picture of a basketball wearing a crown, and the image was surrounded by the words, "The game chose me," a short text of almost biblical richness. Read one way, the tattoo was a swaggering statement of destiny. I am so perfectly suited to this sport that the game itself was forced to recruit me in order to fully express its true nature, much like Excalibur chose King Arthur. Read another way, however, Sefolosha's tattoo was passive, almost apologetic, an existentialist shrug. Don't blame me. I did not choose this game. I play basketball as the gravedigger digs, or the louse sucks blood. What are any of us but driftwood on the great tides of history, thrown this way or that, until we are inexorably ground into dust against the cruel rocks of fate? This duality made Sefolosha's tattoo the perfect slogan for his talent. When he harassed LeBron into a turnover, or hit a crucial open three, I read "The game chose me" and thought, good job, game. When he dribbled off his foot, or threw the ball into the crowd, or mangled a fast break with an awkward spin move, I thought, this is not Thabo's fault. He never asked for this responsibility. He was just standing on a street corner one day, smoking a cigarette, when the spirit of basketball snatched him up and flung him into a gym. Sefolosha was from Switzerland, the first Swiss player ever drafted into the NBA. As the Thunder rose in its first few years from terrible to dominant, Sefolosha played a key role. He was the anti-Harden. He was important to the team, paradoxically, not in spite of his offensive limitations, but because of them. He didn't need the ball. In fact, everyone preferred for him not to have the ball, or at least to have it only for the fraction of a second it took him to catch and shoot a wide-open three, a skill he had steadily improved. This allowed him to focus on his defense, as well as to act as a buffer in the offense between Westbrook and Durant. A small absence between two massive presences, a little zone of silence between two walls of noise. Even in 2011, when James Harden emerged as an offensive wizard, Sefolosha held the starting spot. His presence became a signature of the Thunder's offense, the acid of Westbrook, the base of Durant, the neutrality of Thabo Sefolosha. In the third quarter of the Grizzlies game, all of the hovering, pent-up energy finally broke loose. It came pouring out, naturally, through Russell Westbrook. And it was directed, unfairly, at Sefolosha. The Thunder had come out of halftime still dominating. Their defense was long-armed and swarming. Their offense, funneled through Westbrook and Durant, was overwhelming. The Grizzlies looked dejected and tired. Westbrook was still going after their point guards, especially in the post, down low, where he loves nothing more than publicly humiliating smaller players, turning his back and grinding them into little piles of futility. This game was a full-on Westbrook post-up party. He victimized Mike Conley with another bank shot, drawing another foul. And now he had Bayless on him again, and Westbrook clearly had the exact same thing in mind. This was when everything went wrong. Westbrook dribbled up the court, incandescent with confidence. Kendrick Perkins was wide open on the baseline, and he put his hands up to call for the ball, but Westbrook waved him off, and Perkins shuffled dejectedly away. Westbrook now had the entire left half of the floor to himself. He would have preferred, probably, for all of his teammates to actually leave the building, but the rules didn't allow for that, and he didn't have enough time to arrange the logistics, so he got to work in imperfect conditions. He turned his back and started banging Bayless toward the hoop. Dribble, bang, dribble, bang, dribble, 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 bang. Bayless, however, wasn't giving an inch, so Westbrook turned toward the middle of the floor to look for space. But another defender was waiting there to help. So Westbrook turned back toward the baseline. Bang, dribble, dribble, bang, bang, dribble. only Bayless still wasn't giving him any room. Westbrook turned back to the middle again. Now there was a different defender waiting there to help. Dribble, dribble. Westbrook, the indomitable, the quicksilver, found himself bottled up. What happens to a dream deferred? Where have all the flowers gone? Where are the snows of yesteryear? The whistle blew. Turnover. The officials had called Westbrook for an obscure and rarely enforced basketball crime. Rule 10, Section 16 of the NBA rulebook. An offensive player in his front court, below the free throw line extended, shall not be permitted to dribble with his back or side to the basket for more than 5 seconds. It was a relatively new rule, intended to encourage team play, and it was never called, but you couldn't blame the officials. They were doing God's work. Westbrook was in clear violation of everything true and beautiful about basketball. He had plunged off the cliff of self-interest. He had dribbled 10 times during that possession, and not one dribble had given him even a split-second advantage. Every problem he'd encountered had represented an opportunity for somebody else. That's how basketball works. But this had never seemed to occur to him. From roughly the third dribble through the sixth, Kevin Durant had been wide open at the three-point line, holding his hands out in shooting position, actually shouting, "Hey!" But Westbrook, in these situations, has the peripheral vision of a cyclops looking through a paper towel tube, so Durant put his hands back down. Around the eighth dribble, Cephalosha came sprinting through the lane, trying to give Westbrook a target to pass to. He was open for half a second. Little Mike Conley, Cephalosha's defender, seemed to have been hypnotized by Westbrook's dribbling, along with everyone else in the arena. Cephalosha had scored on a similar play, on a pass from Durant, only a minute before. But Westbrook didn't see the cut. All he knew was that Cephalosha's defender had come over and ruined his opportunity, bottling him up. That was when the whistle came. The referee's whistle set off a feverish melodrama out on the floor. Every single one of Westbrook's teammates immediately threw his hands up in disgust. Not at the call, but at Westbrook. Scott Brooks, sitting on the bench, looked like he'd been hit in the back of the neck with a tranquilizer dart. He stared blankly, paralyzed with wonder. Westbrook, meanwhile, was incensed. He felt, somehow, that he had been wronged. This injustice would not stand. He spiked the ball on the court, hard, twice. Even Westbrook's rage was expressed through over-dribbling. And in that moment, his anger latched onto Thabo Cephalosha. Right there in public, in the middle of 18,203 fans, in front of a national TV audience, Russell Westbrook screamed at his Swiss teammate, the very model of NBA mildness. Cephalosha, out near the three-point line, stood his ground and tried to explain himself, using his hands to mime the nature of the game as it actually existed outside of the sealed chamber of Westbrook's furious mind. In the optimistic early days of Cephalosha's career, he had once described basketball as a paragon of democracy. "When you're on the basketball court, everybody's the same," he said. "Everybody's got 2 legs, 2 arms. Durant and Perkins were yelling at Westbrook to stop yelling at Cephalosha. "Come on, Russ," they shouted. Meanwhile, as the Thunder conducted its Socratic dialogue about the true nature of basketball, "Durantus, surely you saw that I was open. Westbrook, but can anyone be more open than a man who already possesses the ball?" The Grizzlies had inbounded and were charging up the court to score. Bayless drove toward the hoop, and instead of forcing his own shot in traffic, passed out to Marc Gasol for a wide-open jump shot. Swish. Teamwork 101. Easy. Bayless, Westbrook's inferior nemesis, suddenly looked like the most sensible point guard on the floor. This was more than Westbrook was willing to endure. He took the inbounds pass, charged down the floor, leaped into 2 Grizzlies, and fired off one of the wildest shots you are ever likely to see in a professional contest of any kind, a leaning, flying fling that had 0 chance of going in. If he was trying to prove something, he had succeeded in proving its opposite. This was the 2nd Thunder possession in a row that Westbrook had wildcatted into smithereens, the second time in a row that none of his teammates had touched the ball. To make things worse, Westbrook's shot missed so badly that it jump-started a Grizzlies fast break, which ended in the worst possible way, with Bayless flying past Westbrook for a dunk. Scott Brooks roused himself from the depths of a million slumbers and called a timeout. He pulled Westbrook from the game. Westbrook went to the bench, but he was far too furious to sit, too betrayed by humanity and probability and physics and time. So instead, he stomped over to the last chair in the row, Daniel Orton's chair, and he threw it over. Orton, standing there, considered saying something, but in the face of Westbrook's wrath, he kept quiet, and he watched his point guard go charging off down the tunnel toward the locker room. Mo Cheeks, Westbrook's mentor, hurried after him. Unless a player was injured, leaving the floor in the middle of the game was taboo. In the tunnel, Westbrook was beside himself. He couldn't understand why everyone was yelling at him. In the minutes following the incident, the Grizzlies cut the Thunder lead from 25 down to 10. Westbrook's tantrum had turned the blowout back into a real game. I love capitalism. On the evening news on August 5th, 1979, the tail end of a momentous decade in OKC, a helicopter circled downtown. This was Sky 5, trusted local source of wide-angle traffic shots and wildfire panoramas and updates on looming weather. Now, however, the helicopter's camera had zoomed in on a building, the Tivoli Inn, which stood alone at the intersection of Main and Robinson. Downtown, in this aerial view, was almost scary in its emptiness. For most of its life, the Tivoli Inn had stood directly next to the Biltmore Hotel, enjoying the same teeming wealth of shops and tourists and restaurants. By now, all of that life had been scraped away. The helicopter showed a landscape that could be described, quite reasonably, as post-apocalyptic. There were no shoppers. The streets were barren. Nothing moved. Although something big was about to happen, no crowd had gathered to watch. The helicopter hovered, recording the blankness, until, suddenly, the Tivoli Inn exploded. The building turned to smoke, just as the Biltmore had 2 years before, and collapsed into nothing. The void at the center of the city expanded. The vastness became more vast. "Only empty land now," said the news anchor. "But soon, the Oklahoma City of the 80s will rise from the dust." It was still possible, just barely, to believe this. By the end of the 1970s, the pay plan looked like a disaster. The Phoenix of urban renewal had, as planned, reduced the city center to ash, but almost nothing new rose out of it. No one lived downtown anymore, and no outsider went there on purpose. What hope for rebirth was left came from deep beneath the ground. A new oil reserve had been tapped in the Anadarko Basin, and OKC's energy companies were swarming all over it, sucking up the wealth. As a result, in the late 1970s, the city's economy was booming harder than it had ever boomed. Construction sites were opening everywhere. Oklahoma City's infinite roads filled with Cadillacs. Oil men flew around the region on private jets, the way kids ride bicycles. Helicopters whisked people off for quick lunches in Dallas. From all over the world, fortune hunters streamed to Oklahoma City. Pouring fuel onto this explosion was an odd local bank that, almost overnight, managed to turn itself into a major player in the U.S. economy. The bank was a novelty in many ways. For one thing, it was located at the Penn Square Mall. Also, it had a drive-through window. Most important, though, it operated less as a bank than as a geyser of money, gushing loans toward anyone who happened to glance in its direction, private or corporate, rich or poor, qualified or not. There were red flags everywhere, but it was money, and it was available, and the rewards were too urgent to allow time to worry about the risks. Penn Square Bank was, in other words, the perfect boom bank. In order to maximize profits, it aggressively ignored most of the safeguards set up to keep financial institutions from failing. It sold shares of its loans to other banks all over